Hello and welcome to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. I'm Richard Davis, and I hope you'll stay with me for the next hour. During that time, we'll be hearing about an innovative project to document the history and occupancies of most of the houses in Brighton and Hove over the past 300 years. Then Chris English will be giving us an instant review of the performance of the show Dirty Dancing, which took place at the Theatre Royal just recently. And Colin Vincent will be telling us about the Brighton and Hove Older People's Council and about the question of whether it will continue to exist in the future. Finally, we'll be hearing again a piece which we first broadcast this time last year concerning community pharmacies and the threat which is currently hanging over their heads. As usual, we'll be giving out various email addresses, website addresses and telephone numbers during the course of the programme. So you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. So let's get started with My House, My Street. You may remember that in the edition of At Home This Morning, which we broadcast a few weeks ago, Maya Davis spent some time going round the Regency townhouse in Hove and finding out about the history of the building and what's being done to bring it back to nearly its original state and to throw it open to the public. While she was there, she discovered that a project was taking place to document the history of nearly all the houses in the Brighton and Hove area that are more than 300 years old. It's called My House, My Street. And we thought it was such an interesting project that we'd devote a separate item to it in At Home This Morning rather than lumping it in with the rest of our coverage of the Regency townhouse. And so today is the day when we broadcast that separate item. To find out more about the project, Maya first spoke to the curator of the Regency townhouse, Nick Tyson, and began by asking him what exactly his position in the organisation is.
I'm called the curator here at the Regency townhouse. I'm also the project's founder, founding the project back in the 1980s, and I've looked after its development ever since. The project here is to restore a pair of listed buildings and put the rooms back into a sort of historic timeline, let people walk in, see how people used to live, and to provide through the resources here, the volunteer spaces and what have you, other ways of accessing information about Brighton history and Georgian Victorian history across the internet via exhibitions, workshops and outreach programmes that we run in third-party locations and have done over the sort of past 30-odd years. So our reach is very broad. Some people I meet from Southeast Asia and far very distant locations say to me, "Oh yes, Regency Townhouse, we know about you because..." And it's because one of our projects has gone out there. And I sometimes think there are more foreign people that know about us than there are local people in the Brighton area.
Can you tell me about My House, My Street?
Of course. So My House, My Street began in 2007-08. And it was a sort of bit of blue sky thinking, really. We were sitting down as a small group and discussing how could you engage people, more people with heritage. And we came up with an idea that essentially runs along the lines of, if charity begins at home, does heritage begin at home? And what I mean by that is, could you interest people in heritage by evidencing to them that the place where they live has a heritage, the intimate space they occupy as a house? And it can be interesting both to them and to third parties. And by virtue of the fact that their immediate surroundings are interesting, their neighbours are probably interesting too, and then suddenly the street's interesting and the street's a part of a neighbourhood, and you grow that interest. So we had a very simple idea. If we selected a single Brighton street that most people would describe as very average, and we analysed the history of the street and the people who are in it since the time the street was first built, and then staged an exhibition in that street, could we interest people in the street? And the street we chose was Foundry Street in the North Lane, and when we opened up and provided public access to the street for 9 hours, we had nearly 1,000 people come along. And we were absolutely blown away with the success. They were coming to see posters that we've made and planted on the front of each house that told you the story of everybody who'd lived in the house from the time it was built to the modern period and what was happening in the house. So was it residential, was it a bakery, or whatever it might have been. And to complement the posters, we've written a street history, and we were providing street tours up and down, so sort of fast 10-minute walk up and down the street and have a bit of interpretation. And so those very simple offers engaged all these people to come and have a look. Fantastic people bringing memories. I used to live in the street in 1932. The post office bought that whole part of the terrace for the people who worked in the adjoining postal department. Those sorts of things coming out. And so the following year we tried 4 streets. That worked very well. The following year we tried 10 streets. And then we began to think in terms of, can we make some sort of online provision where people could find some of the information that we were gathering, and it could act as an archive location. People could go back and take a look at it. And the Heritage Lottery Fund very generously joined in and provided us with some funds to do that, pay programmers and developers for website production. We got a bit, so we over-delivered on the project. We set out our aims and ambitions to the lottery, but what we didn't mention to them was that in the course of using their money, we were going to digitise an additional 103,000 pages of Brighton Street Directory, going back to 1784 and up to 1974, and put them all online free to access for the public. And sort of doubled the number of streets that we were meant to process in the course of running that project. But we got through that, we did all those things, then carried on the project up to the end of the funding, just using volunteer inputs, and lately have been in a position, because of the sort of very large quantities of effort that we've successfully delivered, to go back and gain a bit more funding from them, and that's allowing us now to really grow the whole project. So My House, My Street, which focused on some particular areas of Brighton, is being rebranded and is going to become known as Here in the Past. And Here in the Past is going to offer anybody in the Brighton conurbation who lives in an older historic street the chance to find data about their home in their street. So we've gone from being a little sort of neighbourhood, several neighbourhoods around Brighton project, with My House, My Street, to Here in the Past, offering everybody in Brighton Hove in an older house the chance to find out about who was there before they arrived. Very, very exciting and engaging lots of volunteers.
And how do people get involved in My House, My Street, or Here in the Past, as you now call it?
Well, they make contact with us at the townhouse, so they can do that through various volunteering interfaces, agencies around the town that recruit people into projects. They can make direct contact with us. They can either email me, I'm Nick, N-I-C-K, at rth.org.uk, RTH Regency Townhouse. They can email office at rth.org.uk. They can phone us, telephone numbers online and in the telephone books under Regency Townhouse. And one of us will be really happy to talk to anybody that wants to come along and volunteer. We'll schedule them probably in for the following week to come in for a meeting, make sure they like us. And if they do, then we'll set them off on a project. Try and style what they're doing to their particular interests where we can do that.
Great. Thank you very much, Nick.
Pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Well, after she'd spoken to Nick Tyson, Maya went up to one of the upper floors of the Regency Townhouse, and in a little room at the back, she found a whole group of people sitting at computer screens on which were reproductions of various old documents. The first person she spoke to in the room was called Judy, and Maya asked Judy what she was doing.
Well, as you can see, I'm listing, for instance, at number 42, there's a Mrs. Holford. She's a pork butcher, and she has been for quite a few years. And this information can be used in all different ways in other projects. If somebody's researching, for instance, if they live in Gardner Street now, and their name happens to be Silverthorne, they might want to look up and see Silverthorne and how far back they go. And it's interesting to see what they did. And sometimes they change. And the interesting thing for me is the spellings change, because I was a legal secretary and spelling mattered. And obviously in those days it was a little bit variable.
I can see there's some names there that have vanished now, like Freeman, Hardy and Willis.
And the interesting thing about this one is if you look at the manager of Freeman, Hardy and Willis, which were shoe people, his name is A. Shoesmith.
An early example of nominative determinism.
As one of my friends in the room told me, so I've written it down.
There's been a lot of New Scientist about it.
Well, thanks, Judy. And then moved on to speak to somebody else.
My name's Teresa and I'm part of the project for My House, My Street, now called Here in the Past.
And was that your job originally?
No, I was originally in pensions, law and tax, so got sick of that, so this is much more interesting. Once we'd done the street directories, because the street directories are more straightforward because they're printed documents, although some of them are quite interesting when the paper quality is bad. So you can see how it varies. Like after the war, and a lot of it gets very absorbent and can be quite difficult to read. But once we've done all the street directory histories, then we have a look at the censuses for the particular street as well. So with those, you've got the challenge of the handwriting, the different styles of letters that we use and how scripts changed over the years, and also sometimes it hasn't been preserved very well. So that's quite challenging, or it can be. But the beauty of that is you can then cross-refer back to your street directories, and that helps you with the interpretation of some of the words that you can't read. But you also get an idea of, so this person owned a business in this property, but this person lived there, maybe, upstairs. And you can get a different flavour. So it's a different sort of cross-section of who lived where. And then ultimately you could type in any address in the regions we've looked at in Brighton, and you'll get a full history of whoever lived there, worked there. And then you can find all sorts of other things, like where they came from, when they died, maybe. So it's all part of building this huge database that we can cut in several different ways to help people find out all about Brighton and their family history and their local history.
And it gives a very different perspective, doesn't it? It's all the stuff that's not in the history books.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's fascinating because when I was doing, I did censuses for Marlborough Place, for example, and I was intrigued by, in the late 1800s, the number of foreign servants there were, people from across Europe, and also you find out more about, like, when telephone numbers first appeared. There's always great excitement when people are looking at street directories and telephone number is mentioned. And all these things, it's a lot earlier than you might think. So you see migration and how, you know, and the French traders quite often, Judy's had some, I've had some, and all the different occupations that don't exist anymore, even things like, what on earth is that? And then we have to go and look it up, you know, like a fancy depository. What were fancies when they were sort of like knickknacks and ornaments? So at that stage, you then know people have got more disposable income because they can buy sort of trinkets that they didn't have before. And all this, and the costumes and the fashion houses. And it's just, there's too much to get your head around, really, but it is. You learn something new every week, every property, every everything, basically. So it's fantastic. It's really good fun.
And you're just a volunteer?
Oh, yeah, we're all just volunteers.
Yeah.
Would you like some more people to volunteer and do this?
Of course.
Can you tell us a bit about the adverts?
Oh, yes, I can. When we're doing the street directories, one of the things we put on the database is the publisher. Now, the publishing page is a long way away from the page that you need to be transcribing, and so it's a bit hit and miss. And of course, when you go towards the beginning of these street directories, they have the most beautiful and hilarious advertisements. I mean, they're great from a social point of view of how printing was done and the amazing graphics that they had, but then you get all the miracle cures and then all the things that we laugh at now, like the separate bathing and the endless mineral water manufacturers, cures for baldness, dentistry, false teeth, and it's, you can very easily spend accidentally quite a bit of time while you're still desperately looking for the publisher page, and you suddenly realise that half an hour has gone and you've been laughing too much at all these fabulous adverts. But they do serve a purpose because they do show you, again, all this, it's all the detail of how some things have changed, some things haven't. And it just adds to the mix of the general excitement of what are we going to find today.
Have you ever been tempted to write off for any of the things in the adverts?
Well, we do sometimes say that because they have the prices on them and it was sort of like, bargain, let's go and ring them up and order one now.
And you'd get a shock because it wouldn't cost that now.
Absolutely, yeah, and they wouldn't exist now as well. But we do sometimes do that. We just have a quick have a look and see how. It might look quite cheap, like sixpence. So for some younger listeners might not know what sixpence was, but you know, our generation would think that was quite cheap. But when you go back and do the conversions, that's another example of how things were quite expensive. So the more prosperous people would have afforded them, and the ordinary men and women probably wouldn't. So it's just everything you do, there's a different layer, a different aspect, and you learn something that you didn't know the week before.
Maya Davis was talking to Nick Tyson and to a couple of other people at the Regency Townhouse about their project, which used to be called My House, My Street, and has recently been renamed Here in the Past. If you'd like to find out more, you can do so by visiting the Regency Townhouse website, which is at www.rth.org.uk. That's www.rth.org.uk. You can also contact them by email. If you want to contact Nick himself, his address is nick@rth.org.uk. That's Nick, N-I-C-K, at rth.org.uk. Or you can email their office, which is office@rth.org.uk. And you can also phone them on Brighton 206 306. That's 01273 206 306. Oh, my colleague Chris English has been to the theatre again, and he's come in to give us a review of the show that he saw. So, over to you, Chris.
Good morning, Richard. I thought I'd just pop in and tell you all about Dirty Dancing, which, you remember, we spoke to Michael O'Reilly in the last edition of the programme. Well, it was on at the Theatre Royal, and I went along to see it. And very good it was, too. Michael O'Reilly, who plays Johnny Castle in the show, was absolutely terrific. Bare buttocks and all, I should warn you. But it's only a fleeting glimpse, so don't get too excited, ladies. But the real star of the show was the girl that plays Frances Baby Houseman, otherwise known in real life as Kira Malou. Absolutely the star of the show, couldn't be better, looked the part, sang the part, danced the part. She was absolutely stunning. If I had to have any criticism of the show, it would be the set. The set is rather too large for the Theatre Royal's compact stage, and it means that the dancers, energetic as they are, had to walk around and dance around the set, and the set changes sometimes disrupted the performance. But all in all, the cast gave their all, and it was a tremendous show, one to be recommended if you can catch the tour somewhere else around the country. There is, incidentally, in the cast a Brighton girl who is Millie Hood, and she trained at the Burrs School in Brighton, and she is in the ensemble and has, I think the expression is, legs to die for. But all in all, it was a great show, a standing ovation at the end from the packed audience on a Monday night, would you believe, in the Theatre Royal. And I think it's very true to the film. Lots of musical numbers, 32, would you believe, in Act 1. There's slightly less in Act 2, but of course the show does end with the classic number, I've Had the Time of My Life, which we played out the last edition of At Home this morning. So that's Dirty Dancing, and as I say, you can catch it somewhere else on the tour in due course. Back to you, Richard.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Well, with me in the studio today is Colin Vincent, who's the chairman of the Brighton and Hove Older People's Council, and he's come in to tell us a bit about the council. So, Colin, could you start by telling us what the Older People's Council is?
It's a body whose objectives are to defend and improve local services for older people. We're not part of the local authority. We are a separate body, but we're supported by the council, and we're often described as a critical friend of the council.
So you're independent of them, but you get to put a word in the ears of the city councillors.
Yeah, we can...
If you think they're not doing enough for older people, is it?
That's right, that's right. We can ask council officers to come along to one of our business meetings and question them about issues like health, social services, transport, the environment, all issues that affect the lives of older people.
And are the city councillors obliged to take notice of what you say to them?
They're not obliged to take notice, but we have been able to influence them on issues over the last 15 years. An example is that 2 years ago they decided that they were going to limit the use of the concessionary bus pass. So it started at 9:30 and not 9 a.m. in the morning. They wanted to move that to a later time, and we were one of the principal objectors to that decision, and the decision was changed, and I think we were greatly responsible.
Oh, that's good. As somebody who holds a bus pass, I can only congratulate you on that. When was the Older People's Council first set up?
The nucleus of the Older People's Council goes back to 2001. It was set up by a cross-party group of senior councillors, and they, together with officials of the council, drafted a constitution which still survives to this day.
I gather this, that Brighton is unusual in actually having an Older People's Council.
Yes, it is. It's unique in the UK, and it's based on a model that operated, and I think still operates, in Denmark, where their local authorities are required to consult with a group of older people on decisions that they make.
And how many members does the Older People's Council have?
It has 9 elected members, and it can co-opt up to 4 members who have special expertise, interest in matters that affect older people.
And how are the members selected?
Well, they can apply to become co-optees, and they appear before the Older People's Council and are selected. It has to be a unanimous decision, but that's the way it operates.
You say that the majority of the members are actually elected.
Yes, they are. They submit themselves to election every 4 years, in the same way that local councillors have to submit themselves for election.
I know every 4 years I receive a ballot card to invite me to vote for members of the Brighton and Hove City Council, but I don't remember ever receiving anything about the Older People's Council.
Well, when you registered for a bus pass, you should have been asked to go on the electoral list for the Older People's Council ballot. People over 70 should automatically get a ballot paper, a postal ballot paper, through the post to vote. That's the way it's set up.
And is it sent out by the same people who send out the ballot papers for the main council elections?
It should be, yes.
Do the elected members of the OPC represent particular areas of the city of Brighton and Hove?
Yeah, we do. The elected members cover usually 2 or 3 wards put together to form an area which one member will represent. We don't do individual casework like councillors do. We campaign on issues that affect pensioners and older people as a constituency, as it were. Yeah.
But presumably, if an older person had a particular concern, they could bring it to their local OPC member.
Yeah, if it's an issue that affects a group or older people in the city, then we could take that up. But if it's a personal issue, then we would direct them to their local councillor.
And are all the members of the OPC volunteers?
They are all volunteers. They don't receive allowances like elected councillors, but we do get out-of-pocket expenses if we have to attend meetings or go on courses or approved by the council. And we get administrative support from the council.
If somebody wanted to volunteer to stand as a candidate in the OPC elections, how would they go about it?
Well, they would submit their inquiry of the electoral services, and they would receive a nomination form, and that nomination form has to be, or would be, endorsed by two older people, and it would then be asked to submit a short election address, and then they would then be included in the ballot.
You say electoral services. Is that the same organisation that organises the main council election?
That's right, yeah.
So you could find their contact details on the council website, presumably? Or by phoning the council?
Yeah.
So the OPC members, as you say, are all volunteers, but you can claim expenses. But the OPC must have other running expenses, such as, for example, the organisation of the elections and organisation of meetings and so on. Where does the money actually come from?
Well, it comes out of the council's general fund, but all that is under threat. In the 2016-17 budget, the council, in their wisdom, made the decision that they wouldn't support the elections in 2019. Unfortunately, it was supported by the principal administration party and endorsed by the principal opposition parties, despite our campaign to change their view about all the people and the importance of them having a democratic access to the voting procedure. There was a little consultation about the council's decision. We did protest at the council meeting as a group, but that didn't change the situation. There was no consultation whatsoever, as far as we're aware, with the 40,000 older people in the city who would be denied an opportunity to vote for the Older People's Council in 2019.
So, what's going to happen in the future then?
Well, that's a good question. We're having to wrestle with that probability at this particular stage.
Is it possible the OPC might cease to exist?
It is a possibility. And we will endeavour to do the best we can. We've decided to take out a service agreement with a voluntary organisation in Brighton, though it was a controversial decision, to provide administrative services to the OPC. Without that, we will be struggling to continue to exist.
So it's very much up in the air at the moment, then?
It is. We're operating this service agreement. It comes under review in a few months' time, but without that, we couldn't cover the range of issues that we have previously.
OK, so the situation is very, very much fluid at the moment. If people want to find out more about the OPC, how can they go about it?
Well, we have a website. If people just Google Brighton and Hove or the People's Council, they'll be able to get a range of information from our website.
Thanks, Colin. Colin Vincent has been telling us about the Brighton and Hove Older People's Council. And if you'd like to find out more, you can go to their website, as Colin said. The address of the website is www.olderpeoplescouncil.org. That's www.olderpeoplescouncil, which is typed all as one word with no spaces, .org. Well, if you've just joined me, a very warm welcome to you. My name is Richard Davis, and this programme is entitled At Home This Morning. It's a magazine programme intended for older listeners. And it's being broadcast on Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM and DAB Digital Radio in the Brighton area, and also on the internet at www.radioreverb.com. Now, to finish our programme, I'm repeating an item that we first broadcast in October of last year. It's a piece about community pharmacies. The reason I'm repeating it is because I recently received a letter from the NHS telling me about a new scheme whereby I can get my prescription dispensed by post from a large company that serves the whole of Britain. And this was one of the threats to the existence of community pharmacies, which was mentioned in the interview I'm about to replay. To tell us more, here's Peter Lloyd.
You probably recall that a few years ago, the chemist shops started to have a long list of services that they provided, which they would hang in the window of the shop. They were there to produce all kind of information and advice about medication. They were there to give tests of cholesterol, blood pressure, and so on. They were there to give advice on contraception and quitting smoking. And many of them had a small room which they could use for independent and confidential discussions, so that you weren't having to discuss all your problems in the middle of a shop crowded with people. And then recently it's been argued that community pharmacies and the pharmacists should be much more involved in minor medical matters, matters which didn't really need you to go to A&E or GP. And this is continuing up to the present day. I have with me today Penny Woodgate, who is Communication and Engagement Officer for the Surrey-Sussex Pharmacy Association. So, Penny, would you like to describe some of the things that pharmacists are being urged to do nowadays?
Yes, of course. I think one of the main things which has been very progressive is that now we can provide the NHS flu vaccination service, which runs alongside the GP vaccination service. That is a flu vaccination for all adults aged over 65 and those between 18 and 65 in certain risk groups. And to unpaid carers, where they're the main carer of an older or disabled person, and who could be at risk if the carer was ill. So that has been a really progressive move, and it's certainly been a very, very useful move to improving patient choice. So whether it's with your GP practice or with your community pharmacy, patients now have the choice to get their flu vaccination at a time convenient to them, and we'd urge people to take up that opportunity. Regarding other progressions, we still, of course, have the public health services that community pharmacies provide. They're commissioned by the local council. That's help with stop smoking, emergency contraception, help with substance misuse harm reduction. And of course, the things that we do every day, which is funded by the pharmacies, not by the NHS, and that includes the free delivery of medicines. That's been ongoing. And also the provision of reminder charts and aids to help people manage their medicines in their own home. And where we can support them to remain independent in their own home. Help and advice regarding when they're given a new medicine. It comes under the New Medicine Service. And this, again, is a service that has been commissioned for quite a long time. But a good example would be if you're given a new inhaler, whereby at the point of issue, the pharmacist will run through how to use it and then follow up in a week's time and then another couple of weeks after that, which really does give you time to start to use it, come back to the pharmacist with any queries. And then, of course, if there's anything to sort out, the pharmacist can contact the GP with your consent. The medicines use reviews or medicines checkups that pharmacies carry out, they're a very, very good way of helping people understand why they take their medicines, what side effects they are, getting through any issues or concerns that people might have, or worries about particular medicines or whether they can all be taken together. And also that service is a really good one for helping to reduce waste as well. Because someone may not be able to use a particular inhaler, for example, because perhaps their arthritis might have developed and they now can't use that anymore. And it's a simple case of reviewing it and suggesting an alternative. So they're the standard services that all pharmacies can provide. And we have 59 pharmacies across Brighton and Hove. Looking towards the future, as Peter has already mentioned, pharmacies now have the consultation rooms, which means these services can be provided and are in a confidential environment, which lends itself to pharmacies taking on a wider role to help the public stay healthy and also for them to become a first port of call for any symptoms, queries over their medicines, minor conditions, which can be dealt with by the pharmacist. And actually, it's quite interesting that at least 19.5 million GP appointments could be transferred to community pharmacy.
So the upshot of all of this seems to indicate that we should all be on extremely good terms with our local pharmacy and look upon the pharmacy as the first port of call for any illnesses or minor complaints. But on the other hand, what one notices at present is increasing calls on all public services to examine the processes, make sure that they can't produce the same level of service for a lot less money. Is this something that we should be concerned with here?
What we have seen is since the Department of Health slashed the funding by 113 million in December 2016, we have seen pharmacies work to continue to put their patients first, to do their best to continue to provide delivery services, to do their utmost to maintain and, where possible, expand the services they offer to maintain that quality of service provision for you and for patients. At the moment in Brighton and Hove, we have excellent service provision that people have strived to maintain despite the cuts, because we are a profession that is trusted, valued, and we'll do our utmost to always put patients first.
Another threat to the community pharmacy seems to be that a lot of their work concerns repeat prescriptions, and so a large portion of their income comes from these. But one's seen in recent months the growth of a number of very large pharmaceutical organisations which promise to organise everything with your GP electronically, and they will remind the GP or remind you when a repeat prescription is due, send it in to the GP, get it back, and then have their own vans to bring the medications around to your house. Well, this would seem to me to be extremely threatening to the local community pharmacies, because a lot of us have received flyers in recent weeks urging us to change from the local community pharmacy to this larger organisation.
I think we need to all remember that we all have a choice, and it's a patient choice as to where you get your medicines from and where you go to receive advice on health and medicines. And I would urge anybody who receives any information regarding any pharmacies who might be promoting a change or a switch to using somebody else, that they first of all contact your local community pharmacy and just check, has that come out from them? Remember that if we don't use our local community pharmacies, we will lose that trusted, valued clinician that we can access on our high street out of hours when the GP surgery is closed. There's a lot of different factors here, but I think the key thing is always try to think of your community pharmacy as your local wellbeing hub. They actually did some research in 2015, and they analysed 12 community pharmacy services across public health, medicine support and support for self-care. And that included actually auditing the amount of time spent talking to patients, giving advice, all of which we don't get paid for. They actually found that the 12 services they looked at delivered £3 billion worth of net benefit to the NHS. And that is the value that we're urging the Department of Health to actually recognise, and are just part of the added value of us being a community asset. Over the years, pharmacies have really invested in their pharmacies. I've seen an immense change from the pharmacies who used to be someone just selling shampoos and other things, ancillary items. Mm-hmm. Now they are a professional place where, as I say, consultation rooms take place, flu vaccination, medicines reviews. And really we are now in a position to take the pressure from GPs, take the pressure from A&E. We've got 11,000 clinical pharmacists in our communities already. Let's put that to good use and let's actually get some targeted funding into community pharmacy services.
So the upshot of our discussion seems to be, if you really do value the service that your community pharmacist gives, use it. Otherwise, everything will become lacking in any form of personal contact. Penny Woodgate, thank you very much.
Peter Lloyd has been talking to Penny Woodgate, who is the Communications and Engagement Officer for the Surrey and Sussex Pharmacy Association. And that brings us to the end of our programme for this time. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in this edition of At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you in 4 weeks' time. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me to let me know what you think of the programme, or perhaps to suggest items you might like me to cover in future editions, I'd love to hear from you. There are two ways of getting in touch. You can either contact me by email at the following address, info@greymattersproductions.org.uk. That's info, spelled I-N-F-O, at greymattersproductions, which is typed all as one word, .org.uk. Or you can contact me via the Radio Reverb website. If you go to the website and find the page that's devoted to At Home This Morning, you can send me an email from there. And whichever method you choose, I'd love to hear from you. So until we meet again, this is Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, wishing you all the very best. Goodbye.
At Home This Morning is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb.